This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You may have heard of food deserts, areas of town where it's hard to get fresh fruit and vegetables, but what about news deserts? As media outlets struggle in the face of shrinking ad revenue and declining newspaper subscriptions, there are fewer reporters covering local politics, City Hall, and other beats that have a big impact on people's lives. Report for America aims to change that by putting emerging reporters into these so-called news deserts. Kim Kleeman is National Director of Report for America.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for joining me. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've got quite a few journalists being hired this year and sort of joining these local news organizations. I read it's some 250 across 168 local news organizations. Is that kind of on par with what Report for America normally puts out across news organizations throughout the country?
We are growing exponentially this year. We started in January of 2018 with three reporters, and then we grew to 11 reporters. This past year, we put 60 reporters in the field. Next year, we're going to 250. Our goal is by around 2023, 2024, to have 1,000 reporters in the field.
What's the motivation behind this? I know there's Teach for America, and I'm not sure if Report for America is kind of part of the same pattern of trying to correct the balance a little bit in terms of where teachers are and do the same thing with reporters. Is that sort of the model for Report for America?
Yeah, so there is a huge problem in this country if you approach the world as a journalist does, and that is there are news deserts everywhere. So there are so many unreported and underreported communities and issues. And that is what Report for America is mainly aimed at addressing. So yeah, there are whole communities that have no reporters to cover events. And we think that is eroding democracy also, ultimately. When you don't know what's going on in your community, how can you be civically engaged? How can you know what's going on so that you can address problems? So that's what we're trying to do. A couple other of our goals include we strongly believe that newsrooms need to reflect and better reflect the communities they cover. 40% of our reporters in Report for America are emerging journalists of color. So we really believe that Latinos and African American reporters, Asian American reporters, Native American reporters, we really need to see those reporters better reflected in our newsrooms. So those are among the reporters that we're really trying to recruit for our program. And then a third thing is that we ultimately believe that newsrooms need to get more support from their local communities. Donations need to be coming in to support local newsrooms. So we are working with every one of the newsrooms, or the 165 we have this year, in trying to help them go out to their communities, find local donors so that they can support these Report for America reporters as well as others in the newsroom.
So how do you go about identifying the newsrooms that you want to work with? Are these news organizations that are maybe struggling a little bit financially or don't have the resources to cover the stories in their communities? Or are you looking to just help bolster newsrooms that are doing well anyway?
So we conduct two contests throughout the year. On the one hand, we ask newsrooms that have news deserts, among their coverage areas, that have identifiable beats that they want to have to fill those news deserts. We ask them to apply. We got hundreds and hundreds of applications from pretty much every state in the union except Arkansas, and we looked at each of them and figured out, okay, which ones have the biggest news deserts as identifiable or identified by, various studies? What were the beats that they were suggesting would help fill those news holes? How well could they support a new emerging reporter in their newsroom? So what kind of editing do they give? How committed are they to going out and finding sources of new sources of revenue to help their newsroom? And so we identified 165 that we really want to work with, and have the money to support ourselves. And once that contest is done, the very day that we announced those newsrooms, we opened up applications to reporters so that they could see, wow, we have, you know, three newsrooms in Alaska, which is true. And here are the beats they want covered. Man, I want to put my application in because I want to go there. So we're in the midst right now of fielding applications from reporters. The deadline is January 31st. And so we are the screening organization. We will match reporters with newsrooms. We will give every newsroom 3 to 5 reporters. They will make the ultimate choice. The reporters work for those newsrooms, and we are kind of the intermediary in matching newsrooms with appropriate reporters, and we pay half the salaries of those reporters so that newsrooms can better afford them.
Tell me a little bit more, if you could, Kim Kleeman, about the news deserts that you identified in Florida and some of the news organizations that will be taking part in this program in 2020.
Well, right now we have one reporter who's working at El Nuevo Herald, and he is covering Latino communities in the Miami-Dade area that hadn't gotten a lot of coverage before. We're adding 6 more reporters next year. So we'll have a reporter at the Miami Herald covering economic mobility or lack thereof in Dade County. We're going to have a reporter at Spectrum News 13 in Orlando covering the Central Florida housing crisis. At the Tampa Bay Times, they want a reporter to cover senior issues. And at WLNR Public Media in Miami, a reporter is going to be covering South Miami-Dade, and also another reporter is covering immigration. So I feel like Florida will be well represented with Report for America reporters. And the beats, so the Miami and the Tampa and Orlando beats are critical areas for those readers. And we have, you know, many more examples of that, you know, throughout the country. Immigration issues are really big this year. We have a lot of newsrooms who want to cover health, poverty, bread and butter beats like towns and cities that haven't been covered for years. And, you know, knowing what we know from what the current crop of reporters are covering, when you have a community that has not been adequately covered and you send out a bright reporter with even basic knowledge of public records laws, and you turn them loose in that community, the stories that our reporters are covering now are just incredible.
You mentioned a spread of newspapers, television stations, and public radio in there as well. Are you finding, though, when you look at the news organizations that are looking to partner up with Report for America and put reporters into these areas or on these beats which haven't been covered as much as they would like in the past, is it more on the print side? Is there kind of more of an emphasis on one form of media over the other, or is it spread across the whole spectrum there?
So news deserts are kind of equal opportunity takers, it seems to us. So we have a combination of newspapers and digital-only publications. We about a quarter of our reporters will be going to public and private radio stations, and we also have a complement of TV stations who will be housing our reporters. So, again, you know, all different kinds of media have a need for, you know, coverage areas that they just haven't gotten around to covering adequately before.
And you talked a little bit about the need for folks on what you call bread and butter beats, like City Hall and kind of more local government stuff. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on maybe the hollowing out of the print media business and how maybe newspapers that might have had City Hall reporters or people following those beats before just haven't. Is that like a particular area you're looking to fill with this program?
I think that is one of the most popular areas of coverage that newsrooms have requested for Report for America reporters. Yeah, where, you know, there might have been, you know, 7 people covering aspects of a city in past years. Now there's one, or there's a freelancer or whatever. And so, you know, absolutely. I mean, this is not about niche-y beats in most respects. This is about real basic coverage that readers are doing without, because the models have been, you know, blowing up, and newsrooms are scrambling to find, you know, better ways to cover these beats.
Have the folks who've been part of Report for America in the past, have they stayed with those newsrooms, or have they gone on to other newsrooms? Do you know, like, how much do you keep tabs on people who've gone through the program?
Yeah, so we are just getting to the point where a few reporters, that first cohort, has passed the two-year mark. And one of them I know has been hired by that newsroom, so that's total success. And a couple others are currently kind of working out deals with newsrooms. So it's a little too early in our program to say that, 99% have been hired by the newsroom, which of course we're hoping for. But they've been hugely satisfied. We get compliments all the time from the newsrooms that have hired or that are working with these Report for America core members. And they're just doing incredible work, and we just couldn't be happier with the quality of news that's coming out of these places.
And Kim, talk a little bit, if you could, about the funding, because you know, in public radio where I work, we're sort of used to the model of going out and talking to our audience directly and saying, look, you can support the reporting that you rely on day to day. And it's a sliding scale, right? It doesn't have a subscription amount attached to it. But I'm sure programs like Report for America, a lot of newsrooms are going to become more interested in these programs as they look for, you know, other sources of revenue, as maybe advertising revenue shrinks and they have to get creative about the way they go about funding the news. So how much support do you offer newsrooms in terms of trying to go out and get those new sources of funding to keep news operations afloat?
We offer a lot of support for newsrooms trying to find extra funding. So first of all, we pay half the reporter's salary, and the newsroom is responsible for the other half, but we strongly encourage them to go get half of their half from their local community. So in the past, we have actually written the grants for newsrooms. We have overseen crowdfunding campaigns. We help newsrooms identify potential local donors who are interested in the topics that their Report for America core member will be covering. So it's just whatever the newsroom feels comfortable with. I mean, some newsrooms are way more comfortable than others in seeking donations. So it's really up to the newsroom, but we have really been in there helping in a granular way if that's what they need and want.
As you look ahead to 2020, Kim, what stories are you most interested in looking for more reporting on and seeing what some of the folks in the program come up with in terms of what they're producing for their newsrooms?
Well, we have always said that we work for the newsrooms and the communities. So it's not a question of, what beats do we think are the best or the most creative? It's really what the newsrooms need. I mean, this past year, some of the stories that these reporters are breaking. So let me just say we have a reporter in Maine. Her name is Samantha Hogan. She has investigated and broke a bunch of stories about the fact that attorneys are overbilling the state of Maine by millions of dollars. These are attorneys who the state pays to represent the indigent. In Texas, we had a reporter break a story about a U.S. citizen detained by border control for 3 weeks with no clear cause. And as soon as he wrote a story, it went viral. The reporter was featured on CNN. The next day, the guy was released. In Utah, the county commission of the poorest county ended up paying a lobbying firm $500,000 to lobby for the reduction in size of the Bears Ears National Monument This is a county where most of the population did not agree with that decision, and the county paid the same $109,000 bill twice. I mean, there's just these incredible local stories, and they haven't been covered before, and it's just so powerful to see how the public, how readers are responding to that kind of news. And the way they are is with $5 and $10 donations saying, keep it up. This is what we need out here. Keep up the good work. That is hugely encouraging. So I don't have a beat that I find, you know, more interesting than another, but I do love to see when editors out there are targeting what needs coverage in their community, and these reporters are coming in and doing it so well, and the community is responding.
Kim Kleeman is the National Director of Report for America. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, how do you teach math and science in the 21st century? We'll talk to an elementary school teacher who went back to school herself to get the tools she needs to teach STEM. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. As Florida's population grows, so does the need for teachers. And here in Central Florida, on the doorstep of the Space Coast, there's a push to boost STEM education. UCF has partnered up with Orange County Public Schools and Lockheed Martin in a program to give emerging teachers in that field a boost.
I'm joined by Jessica Granahan. She's a fourth grade elementary teacher at Lawton Childs Elementary in Orlando. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Also joined by Lisa Deeker. She is Pegasus Professor and Lockheed Martin Eminent Scholar at the College of Community Innovation and Education. Thank you so much as well.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
So, Jessica, let's start with you. You're a recent graduate from a new program, a Master of Education in K-8 Math and Science.
Yes, I am.
Tell me about the program. What does this give you in terms of extra tools taking into the classroom?
So for me, it gives me an incredible amount of tools because my undergrad was in English education for secondary, and I had no background in mathematics whatsoever. I had very little background in elementary ed. I was just teaching reading when I started the program, and then I became a math teacher as I was in the program, so I kind of went... Everything that I was learning at school, I was able to then use in my room, mm-hmm. which was amazing because I think a lot of the people in the cohort were already teaching, and me, it was all new, at once.
Were you a math whiz in elementary school yourself? Like, did you gravitate towards numbers and stuff?
No. I was one of those people that was good at math because I taught myself math, and I don't think I ever had great math teachers growing up, so I always believed I was just reading-brained, and that's why I gravitated towards English as my degree in college, because now I'm seeing I didn't have great teachers.
And so what was it that made you think, okay, I need to kind of go back and rethink the way I teach and get some more skills and focus on math rather than what I've been teaching?
I think, well, what we were learning in the program and the way that even just the Common Core standards are having us teach now, it's more why you're doing something. I think when I was taught math, it was more so you need to do this because you need to do this. It is what it is. And I think now we're learning the why to the what, and it makes it a lot more fun. And you're seeing the kids actually understand something. They're not just doing something because they memorized it, which was not the way I was taught, was probably not the way I would have went into teaching math. I probably would have went back to this is how you do it because it works instead of why.
And do you get the sense that there's a shortage of math teachers? I mean, maybe not necessarily your school, but just other schools, other colleagues you might talk to in the system?
Yes, you hear that all the time. That's the one area that is critical is math and science, and it's one area that there's so many jobs opening up for kids when they become of age to get a job. But it's daunting, as it was to me, because that's not how I learned math, and I didn't think I was good at it, and I thought reading is more straightforward, but... Now that I've been through the program and I'm teaching math, that's all I want to teach. I love it. It's completely changed my whole perception of things.
Okay, so Lisa, tell me about the program. Like, how long has it been around for?
So it's an amazing program in the fact that it's been at the University of Central Florida since 1992.
Okay.
So the program came about that four universities were offered a $1 million grant from Lockheed Martin to raise the K-8 teachers and their skill sets in math and science, as you heard Jessica talk about here. And what's interesting is UCF and its, I guess, its youth and its wisdom said, well, we're not sure we want a grant. We'd like to see an endowment. And that became somewhat complicated. Mm-hmm. And so the long story short is that for $1 million, they actually gave us $1,001,000. Mm-hmm. Then it was matched by the state. And we then got funding. We leveraged that funding to get funding from the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. So the first group of cohort of teachers were actually funded in partnership with the guarantee of the endowment and the National Science Foundation. And so the program now has three components. It has the K-8 Teacher Leader Program, which Jessica just graduated from. It also has a transition to math and science program that takes someone with a great background in math and science and makes them a middle school teacher, where there's a great shortage in math and science. And then there's a new component called the Enhancement Grants that allows someone like Jessica a decade from now, and she's like, I want to retool my skills. She can compete for a $1,000 scholarship from Lockheed Martin Corporation to do something to change the learning trajectory further in her classroom in math and science. So we have these three components all endowed by Lockheed from each gift, and those endowment funds then, in the wisdom of UCF, unlike other universities that took it as a grant, will continue forever and ever.
So did you go through the Florida college system yourself?
I did not. I'm an Illinois person.
Oh, okay. Do you kind of pay much attention to what's going on in terms of, you know, concerns about whether it's teacher shortages or the way people are taught or anything like that? Or do you, are you just kind of boots on the ground, let's kind of get the learning done?
So are you talking about shortages and what's happening across the country?
Sure.
Yeah. So one of the things, I've just finished an AERA project, the American Association of Research and Education, where we've been looking at shortages. And the shortages are great in math, science, and special education. And the shortages are really occurring for two reasons. One, because we don't have enough teachers coming in some cases, in targeted areas like math, science. The other issue is we have people leaving the workforce after the first 3 years. Mm. And so it's really a duality problem.
And you're talking about like young teachers.
Young
saying,
teachers.
This is not for me.
Right, right. And usually it's in those first 3 years. Usually if you stay after 3 years, that's why the academy only takes K-8 teacher leaders that are in their third year of teaching. Mm-hmm. Because we want to invest in teachers that were more likely going to stay and right. not exit. So that shortage is not just in Florida. It's a national shortage. But the shortage in Florida, which I've been here for the last 15 years, has really increased greatly because our population keeps increasing. Mm-hmm. And so we can't produce teachers fast enough. To really keep up with the number of students that we're seeing in the classrooms.
Mm-hmm. Do you think if you hadn't taken this course and, you know, this has now kind of changed your career path a little bit,
mm-hmm.
would you still be teaching or do you think you might be considering something else?
I would still be teaching. It may have changed what I consider to do in the future. I think at this point now I would like to go into either just teaching math and science or coaching math and science. Prior, I would have probably just stayed in the classroom or looked more at the reading aspect of things.
Mm-hmm. And what about people who started teaching the same time as you or friends you have in the system? Are they kind of also in that situation where maybe after 3-4 years they're like, I don't know if I want to keep doing this?
I'm at a really great school, and I think that the people that I'm around that are in education, I don't see it as much, but I hear it more so online and in bigger forums of people complaining.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a lot to do with just pay and demands and being able to live up to everything that you have to do. But personally, I don't have any friends that are leaving the profession, but I'm aware that it's something happening.
Back to math and science specifically, Lisa, in Central Florida, we have like a kind of a unique situation because of the space coast,
mm-hmm.
right? And you have
absolutely.
These new industries coming online, like private space companies setting up shop. So do you see the demand for people who have that training, you know, career-wise growing in the future?
Yeah, so I really that is at the core of the academy and why it was created, and I think that will increase. And so the academy was created because Lockheed in its wisdom realized that they needed engineers. Well, mm-hmm. you would think, oh, if you need engineers, you would pay scholarships for engineers. But honestly, when most kids decide their future career at about fifth grade or the age of 11, And so really influencing, as Jessica said, that having great math and science teachers at an early age has really fed into the Central Florida STEM economy by creating teachers who are now producing students early on that say, yeah, this might be a career for me. Mm-hmm. So I believe not only will this continue in what we're doing, but I think we need to expand it and grow it even bigger, because I think we need almost every county to do what we see Orange County doing right now, is really supporting teachers, and not just supporting them, but celebrating them by being sure they're not in debt. And when they're done, they can say, let me use my time and energy not to get a third job to pay off my student loans, but let me plan one more lesson that's effective for my students. And that's what I really think these teachers have done, and the gift that Lockheed and Orange County and UCF has given them together has put them in a whole new spectrum of, I have a master's degree and I'm debt-free, and now I can lead and do something new with my field. So I do think this space race economy here builds even a greater need for stronger K-8 teachers.
What were your math and science teachers like in school?
So I went to a very small rural school, but my dad was a mechanic. And so I learned very early on that anything that was broken, you can fix it if you just figure out and wait long enough. So I think I got a home STEM education. But I do think I also was inspired by some great female teachers, which you didn't see as much in math and science early on. But then I had the opposite when I was in community college. I'm a first generation college student. I do remember a science professor who gave me a poor grade because he didn't think I was a very smart woman. And I didn't know what a Bunsen burner was because I didn't have one in the K-8 school that I went to. And so when I asked what that was, he just from then on really doubted my skills. And I think I'm just strong enough personality. I thought, I'll prove you wrong and I'll prove you different. But I think it takes some power for kids of poverty, first generation students, or for girls in STEM to say, let me fight a different fight to be strong and be a person who can be smart and still make a career, have a family, whatever it is that society expects of females sometimes makes STEM careers harder. I don't know if you see that in your classes.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're teaching, does that kind of go through your mind thinking back to your experience in elementary school and maybe being turned off math and science just because the instructors kind of weren't giving you what you needed?
Yeah, it does. And I think a lot of it was me and not paying attention to my teachers in class because I just wanted to know why things were happening. So it was hours spent at home, going home with my parents and teaching myself and figuring out everything, which makes you not like it as much because I'm sitting in class doing double the hours. But I think now I never was excited in class, and it's nice to see kids excited when it's math time.
One of the challenges I think that teachers must have is homework, right? Because there is quite a lot of it.
Yeah, up to the teacher's discretion.
Sure. Well, I mean, from a parent's perspective, it seems like there's quite a lot. And I think parents sometimes struggle with, like, especially math. It's hard to wrap your head around some of these concepts because it might be different from what you experienced as a kid yourself.
Yeah.
Do you find like you have to do a little bit of like coaching of parents too to help sort of bring the kids along?
Definitely. One thing that I do is I open up my classroom early each day so that they can come in for a half an hour before class and work on any homework if parents weren't able to help them. I also have a lot of parents that don't speak English. So even if they were able to help them with word problem or something, they wouldn't be able to. But another big resource is YouTube. There is tons of videos on YouTube that you could send out through email or through electronic to them, and they can see how to do it and do problems with their kids.
And so thinking about new media, are you starting to use some of those things to reach out to students?
Like yes.
Little short videos or even other forms of social media to get across educational concepts?
Yeah, we watch videos almost every single day in class as kind of like a hook activity. But then to get in touch with parents, there's an amazing app called Class Dojo, and on it, I can send almost like a text message to them. It's like a little Facebook page, and they can write me messages back. I can post stories.
Do you find kids have trouble sort of staying focused? I mean, that's another whole debate, right? Like attention spans are maybe shrinking. There is so much competition for attention. Like, how do you get around that as a teacher?
Movements. We can't just sit there all the whole entire block and watch me on the board. So it's a lot of moving around to different centers or stand up, hand up, pair up, find a partner, answer the question that way. I think movements helps a lot, keeping it more exciting, doing things like a game or have their whiteboards, hold it up. If you're the first one, check your table. It's little things.
Lisa, I'm kind of interested, like the story you were telling about having a dad who was a mechanic and sort of learning how things worked and how you can fix things if you spend enough time with it yourself. Like, how do you think you kind of build that instinct in kids these days?
Well, I think all instincts are built through both families and teachers. I think, you know, this community wrapping around, giving opportunities, whether it's after school clubs, whether it's a teacher inspiring them, whether it's a peer, whether it's the family. But I think what we often forget is that really the best way to learn is the student has to learn it for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes there's this innate need for adults to believe, I got to tell you how to do something, instead mm-hmm. of, you know, you got a flat tire, here's the jack, here's the handle, figure it out. And again, making sure you're safe in that process. And I think that's really the core value in the academy, is really helping these teachers think about how to use math and science as a tool to solve problems in life. Mm-hmm. And how do you think about an algebraic formula to solve a problem that you don't have enough money to go to the movies you want to. Mm-hmm. And that correlation to life and learning is really what I think problem solving and this generation needs the most right now, because most of their jobs don't exist yet.
Right.
And so we can't prepare them for the year 2090 as a teacher because our crystal balls are broken. We don't really know what job they're going to have, but we know that if they're nimble and they can think and they can problem solve, they can do just about anything. And that really is at the core of STEM education.
Is that a real attitude shift from when you were going to elementary school or even, you know, when you're in college?
Yeah, well, I think it's an attitude shift for our whole generation, speaking at my age, that, you know, it was chalk and talk. You stood at the board and everybody was to sit quietly and listen. Well, that's great. But, you know, a lot of my research shows a really high achieving classroom, teacher talk is less than 30%. Mm. And so if the teacher is standing at the board and talking, that student isn't ready for the next generation of jobs. We don't need somebody to send a part down the assembly line anymore. We need somebody to sit in a room and we have a discussion and say, all right, well, here's the problem. Mm. We don't have enough teachers in the space. What do we do to deal with that? How do we leverage, as this program does, a university, a large corporation, and a large school district, and let's make it a win-win for everybody? That's really the jobs of the future. And I think sometimes it's hard for us, being my generation, to shift our way of thinking about teaching because that's not how we were taught. But we were taught for a job that was an assembly line, which is now gone. And I think that's really where we have to go next, is to keep thinking about letting our kids mess up, fail, try things, but to keep them safe in the process.
Well, Jessica Granahan and Lisa Deeker, thank you so much both for joining us.
Great.
Thank you.
Jessica Granahan is a fourth grade elementary teacher at Lawton Charles Elementary in Orlando, and Lisa Deeker is with the College of Community Education and Innovation at UCF. We've been talking about the Masters in Education program in K-8 math and science teaching. Still to come on Intersection, John A. Torres talks about his new crime novel and the state of the news business today. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. For the last couple years, Florida Today news columnist John A. Torres has been documenting cold case crime mysteries in his podcast series Murder on the Space Coast. Now he's published a novel drawing on his decades of experience as a reporter and weaving in elements of stories he's covered himself, including the devastating opioid crisis. The novel, Paradise Rolling, also serves as a meditation on the media business itself. John A. Torres joins me now to discuss his new book.
Thanks so much for joining us again, John.
Well, Happy New Year, Matthew, and it's always wonderful to be on your show.
So you're delving into something a little bit different here. You've got a lot of books under your belt, nonfiction. You've written a children's book, but this is your first foray into sort of crime inspired by true events, right? Just give me a bit about the genesis of why you decided to dip your toe in the water of crime fiction.
Oh, sure. Absolutely, Matthew. Well, this has been sort of a long time coming, and I've been working on it on and off for years and years. And it just sort of started when the entire newspaper industry seemed to start to go belly up a little bit. And I thought that would be a great setting, you know, for a book and try to give readers a sense of what it's like to work in such an important industry, which just can't seem to come up with a successful business model. And so I thought it would just be neat to use a few of the stories that I've used and which I have covered over the years and meld them together. And, you know, our protagonist is this old, gruff sort of news columnist who's not even sure that he wants to reapply for his job, you know, as they're having layoffs and interviews and this push towards online and social media. And then obviously something happens that makes him want to stay. So...
And part of the, well, the key theme of the book revolves around a 25-year-old murder mystery. So you've got somebody who may be in prison when he shouldn't be, and you're sort of delving into that as well. And you spent quite a bit of time, especially with your podcast series, Murder on the Space Coast, looking into those cold cases, right? Was that some rich material for this novel?
I mean, absolutely. Whoever has listened to the podcast, Murder on the Space Coast, can certainly recognize some of the events which have actually happened. But yes, I mean, I've actually covered, two men who were exonerated by DNA who spent over 20 years in prison each, 128 and 122, and who were totally innocent. And, you know, it's of my opinion that they, along with a few others, were sort of, you know, duped by the system and some prosecutorial, you know, conduct. I won't say, you know, misconduct, but it might be misconduct, where they used a dog handler that was fraudulent, some really suspect eyewitness testimony, and some other dubious actions to try and close these cases and, you know, and eventually put innocent men behind bars.
Now, your protagonist, the newspaper reporter Terry Payne, is hydrocodone addicted. And you spent also quite a bit of time covering the pill mill crisis in Florida, right? So talk to me a little bit about that kind of intersection of real life and fusing that into this fictional character.
Right. Well, absolutely. Well, and first of all, I just want to assure all of your listeners that I am not an addict. I am not addicted. But I've always been drawn to protagonists, you know, and main characters who are flawed. You know, it's easy to root for the all-American hero, apple pie eating, you know, he's never had a drink in his life. And I mean, this guy obviously has issues. And as you mentioned, Matthew, you know, Florida, Brevard County has not been immune to the opiate, problem. In fact, where I live on Beachside, we had this, you know, doctor who was pretty much right around the corner from where I lived by the name of Dr. Frank Gaydon, who's now in prison on some other charge, but he had a pill mill and I didn't know what it was. And every morning I would see people lined up outside of his office. I thought it was an employment agency or something. And these, you know, homeless people were showing up to try to get work, but he was handing out pills. And so we've had murders in these beautiful neighborhoods on Beachside and there's lots of crime because of him and this whole epidemic. So yeah, I just wanted just to try to tie both together and make this character somebody who, you know, like I'm not sure that people like Terry Payne right off the bat, but I think they will come to like and appreciate what he stands for eventually.
And to your point, I mean, you've reported on stories of just regular stand-up people who've fallen into that kind of black hole of addiction, right? And you've seen how easy it can be for people to get started on the wrong path and find it really hard to climb back out of it.
Absolutely. I recently was chatting with a Christian missionary friend of mine who he and I had traveled to Haiti on mission trips many times. And I asked him about this missionary who we had met in Haiti, who was just this incredible guy. And he shook his head and he said he became an OxyContin addict. He left his wife and is living in the streets now here in the U.S. And I was floored. And I guess the guy had a back injury and he just became addicted. And, you know, in season 4 of, you know, Murder on the Space Coast, I go into the case of Jeffrey Abramowski, who was a young working, you know, father of two who had a terrible car accident. And he became hooked on drugs. And now, you know, he's in prison for murder. Again, it's a murder that I don't think he actually committed.
Have you had to take a bit of time away from the podcast to focus on getting the book finished?
No, not really. it's been, one of those things, Matthew, where I'll try to wake up a little bit earlier and work on it, or I will, work on it late into the evening. A few years ago, I tore my Achilles and was out of work for about 3 months, and I was able to get a lot of work on it then. But these last, you know, year or so, I've just been really editing, you know, self-editing, tinkering and trying to get it to where I actually wanted it.
Let's talk a little bit more, if we could, about the state of the newspaper industry now, because it sounds like this book has been marinating for a while. And as you pointed out, print media, in fact, has been on a bit of a slide for quite some time. On the other hand, you have, you know, news outlets newspapers and other outlets that are doing some really great groundbreaking investigative work. I wonder how you kind of match up those two things. Like, on the one hand, you have the industry seems to be in crisis. On the other hand, you have an industry that is really doing valuable work. How do you sort of come to terms with those two different facts?
Yeah, well, you know, it's the kind of thing, Matthew, where I think we as journalists have to be willing to change and adapt. And as you know, I mean, I was the columnist here, and I still am the columnist in title, but I primarily am the podcaster now. And so I tell my stories via the Murder on the Space podcast. We have a new podcast coming out in March called Left to Die, and I can get into that in a second if you want. But yeah, I mean, it's been tough trying to balance the needs of the people who still want that print product in their hand and the newer, you know, younger, I dare say, readership that, you know, wants it online. They want it immediate. They want it on Twitter, on Facebook. They want access to it right away. And, you know, I'm not sure that anybody has really figured out how to make a little money doing that. And so, you know, people, look, I think that the entire industry years and years ago made a huge mistake in putting the news up online for free. And I'll always remember when I, you know, one of my first jobs out of college was for United Press International. And this is before the internet, because I'm pretty old. And so we would have, you know, people calling us in the office on Saturdays asking for the scores of college games. And we were instructed to tell them that our business was to sell information. And so we didn't even tell people the scores over the phone. And so for, you know, all these newspapers and you know, all these news sites to just put stuff up for free, and then now we want advertisers to pay for it or the readers to actually pay for it, it's been a tough climb.
Let me just read a little bit from towards the start of the novel, talking about Terry Payne. I'm quoting here, "For guys like Payne who didn't know how to do anything else in this world, the plan was to hold on until the bitter end." End quote. Does that kind of sum up your approach to news, John? I'm wondering if there have been some moments in your career where you've thought, this is it, this industry isn't going to last too much longer, I should start looking for other options.
Yeah, I mean, I have had those thoughts, Matthew, and, you know, it's just that I love what I do so much, and I believe in journalism so much that, you know, maybe I'm naive, but I feel like I feel like I'll always be doing this. I was called to do what I do, and I know I don't want to give it up. So I probably will be holding on until the bitter end. But in that vein, I'm also willing to adapt. And so I'm doing podcasts. I'm doing videos. You know, everything I learned in journalism school, I mean, I am not doing any of that stuff really now. I'm taking photographs. I'm editing video. I'm editing audio. I'm writing scripts. And so whatever I can do to keep journalism alive and important, I will do until the bitter end.
You're also treading some pretty well-trodden territory for either current or former journalists who start writing crime novels, right? And it seems like Florida is pretty rich territory for that, because there are so many interesting stories that either have some connection to Florida or are set here. Do you see yourself sort of fitting into that tradition of crazy crime novelists in Florida?
Well, yes, actually. I mean, I would love to be considered, you know, among them. And the Terry Payne book is, it's called Paradise Rolling, and it's the first in a trilogy, a planned trilogy. I'm already well into the second book, which is called Paradise Drained. And then a third book, and all of them will all be, you know, inspired by true events, inspired by cases that I've covered. The second one, all I have to say is vampire rapist, and I'm sure that some of the listeners will remember John Crutchley here in Brevard County, and it's sort of loosely based on that story, while, you know, we are continuing the path of Terry Payne and following his exploits.
Did you read a lot of crime growing up? Like, was that sort of something that you felt drawn to before you even became a journalist?
Not really. I read a lot of sports and Hemingway and classic literature. And then I guess I started reading, you know, a lot of the John Grisham stuff, you know, when he first came out with A Time to Kill and The Firm. And then, you know, over the years, I seem to gravitate more towards towards literature and you know, almost like fantasy. Like, I love the Japanese author Haruki Murakami. I think it's because I write about true crime so much in my day to day that I need an escape when I'm reading. So, yeah.
does it give you an opportunity to maybe cut loose a little bit? I'm sure, you know, as a reporter and a news columnist, there may be times when you write something that you think's great and then your editor comes back and says, that's gone. We've got to lose that. Does this give you a little more freedom in your writing?
Oh, I mean, absolutely, you know, freedom. And, you know, you've actually had a chance to check out the book. You know, it has some tough language and some rough language and some adult, you know, scenes in there, which obviously I can't write about here at the paper. So it's fun. And it's, you know, sort of fun to also live through Terry Payne. He's, you know, he's a little bit of a womanizer. He's a little bit of, how can I describe him? He's not very likable at first, you know, and he's a drug addict basically. And so, you know, it has been kind of fun to explore life, at least in front of my laptop, you know, through his eyes.
So let's talk a little bit more about the podcast that you're working on that's coming out in March. You alluded to it earlier. What's going on with this podcast?
As you know, we've been doing our Murder on the Space Coast, you know, series. We've had, you know, 4 seasons and an update season. And I just felt like the time was right to change the name and rebrand a little bit, only because I didn't want it to become one of those like Super Bowl things where now it's like Super Bowl XVIIIC, and we don't really know what that means. And so, and I think there was a little confusion over, is Murder on the Space Coast one continuous, you know, story that people have to start with like season one? So it's essentially in the same style as the Murder on the Space Coast, but it's going to be called Left to Die. And it's the story of Crosley Green, who has been in prison now for over 30 years, who was awarded a new trial 2 years ago, you know, by federal court, and the state of Florida has appealed that. And so coming up in March is a gigantic hearing in Jacksonville, Florida, to determine whether the state's appeal and attempt to try and keep him in prison will hold up or not. And again, there is so much dubious, exploits and things in this case. It's really troublesome. He was part of a family that was notorious in Titusville for drug dealing. And what I've been told in the research and investigating that I've done is that the police and the state wanted his family off the streets, basically. And so when a murder popped up, he was sort of, for lack of a better word, framed, you know, for it, is what we think. We will let the podcast and the evidence and the testimony and the interviews, play out. But there's no evidence at all. And it just seems, you know, again, you know, like an easy target. So Chip Flynn was 19 years old, shot and killed at an orange field, and he was left there to die. And Crosley Green was sent to death row and left there to die as well. He has since been taken off of death row and is now serving a life sentence. So that's where the title comes in. Just one telling thing here, Matthew. When Chip Flynn was dying in the orange field, the cops showed up and asked him what happened. And he simply said, I just want to go home. And so because we think that he knew the person who shot him, and it was, you know, accidental perhaps even, and he didn't think he was going to die, but unfortunately he did.
Just thinking about your book, some of the themes in that, and the state of journalism today, do you feel confident about it? I mean, thinking about the new journalists coming through and maybe what the future holds, maybe there's some elements of it we don't quite understand yet, or we're not quite sure the way in which stories will be told in the future, but are you fairly confident that this industry will endure?
Yeah, I mean, you know, absolutely. And I'm not sure if newspapers need to go nonprofit or if they, you know, or whatever, but I'm stunned. I mean, Florida Today here in Brevard County, we basically hired 3 or 4 very young journalists last year who are all incredible. I mean, they are among the hardest working people I've seen there. They are like dogs with bones once they get onto a story. I'm stunned at how many times I've been asked to go and speak to journalism students at Florida Tech in Melbourne. And so there seems to be a real interest and passion for journalism among young people. And so I don't think it'll go away. I think that our business model, you know, maybe has to change, and obviously how it's presented. I think print, you know, unfortunately will eventually die out. But I think people always want real news from credible news sources. And so I'm banking on that.
Right. And so when you talk to some of those young journalists, you must see a little bit of what inspired you to join the business back when you were a cub reporter.
Absolutely. When I was in college, I saw the movie The Killing Fields, you know, about Sidney Schomburg from the New York Times over in Cambodia. And I said, boy, I mean, this is what I have to do. I mean, I have to get into this industry. And, you know, it sounds corny as heck, but I don't care. And to try to shine a light on the injustices and in dark places. And because I think that's, you know, if we don't do it, who will?
Well, John A. Torres is a news columnist with Florida Today. He has a new novel out. It's a book about a reporter called Terry Payne. The book is called Paradise Rolling. John, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, Matthew, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. February marks 1 year since the suicide of TSA officer Robert Henry at Orlando International Airport. WMFE's investigation, TSA in Turmoil, dug into allegations of abuse and retaliation in the workplace culture at TSA. On January 29th, we present our speaker series examining the impact of Henry's death and the investigation, and changes made by TSA to improve workplace culture and prevent suicide. Join us for a panel discussion and Q&A at the Orlando Public Library. You can find details on our website. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.